You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Solomon Rabinovich was born in the mid-19th century in a small, largely Jewish town in the Ukraine near the capital city, Kiev. His fame, however, attaches to his literary creations, all published under the pen name Sholom Aleichem and written in the Yiddish language. A literary specialist in the work of Sholom Aleichem translated his Yiddish pen name to mean "hello again," signifying I'm back with another story and another after that and another. A documentary film on the life and times of Sholom Aleichem, subtitled Laughing in the Darkness, showed earlier this month at Van City Cinema. Martha Roth is a film critic. She's also a member of the Vancouver collective of the Canadian progressive Jewish magazine Outlook. She saw the film, and she joins me in the studio to share her thoughts. Welcome back to Red Eye, Martha.
Thank you, Mordecai. Good morning.
Sholom Aleichem was born in 1859. He died in 1916, a century and a half ago. What cinematic techniques did the director use to bring life to this vanished world?
Well, he did. He ran through pretty much a documentarian's bag of tricks from archival footage. Wonderful. Much of it sourced through YIVO, which is a very rich resource for anybody looking for old film of Jewish life, both in Europe and America, the Americas. He used quite a lot of that, very impressively, combined with interviews with talking heads, critics and scholars of Yiddish literature mainly, including Aaron Lansky. Aaron Lansky wrote a book called Outwitting History, which is a story of how he originated the National Yiddish Book Center in New York. This is national being USA, because Sholom Aleichem died in the United States and always wanted to be a success in New York. But by the way, he also, Sholom Aleichem, invented Yiddish literature. It was not... There was not a literature before him, and his short stories constitute not just the first, but at that time the only writing in the Mamaloshen, the native tongue of many East European Jews.
He lived in a time and in a place, of course, of profound social, political upheaval and change. I wonder if you could maybe sketch some of the main tensions and conflicts in the milieu of Sholom Aleichem.
I thought one of the main strengths of the film was the way it positioned Sholom Aleichem as a writer of his time, a creature of his time, a writer of his time, reflecting intellectual and historical currents. As the narrator of the film tells us, Europe was still undergoing upheavals from the Napoleonic conquests of the early 19th century. There were realignments in empires. There were revolts. I mean, the wave of revolutions in France and Spain in the 1830s and 40s, those were just dying down. There were currents. There were rebellions. And this was reflected also in the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe, although they were not directly affected by those historical events. We all know about the false messiah, Shabbatai Tzvi, in the late 18th century, who, I suppose, the founder of Hasidism, yes, who originated or personified a current of mysticism, anti-intellectual mysticism, a turning away from any kind of assimilation with a wider community, and a turning inward to the mystical roots of Judaism. So that is one strong current in village life, shtetl life in Eastern Europe. And Kiev at that time had a population of fairly assimilated middle-class Jews, and the village life that Sholem Aleichem writes about was very much opposed to that because of the dangers of intermarriage, the dangers of falling away from the faith. So that's a quick and dirty exposition of some of those changes.
I was struck that his father apparently was an advocate of the Enlightenment, of the secular trends, of the modern trends.
Yes, yes, Haskalah. Yeah. Yes, the Jewish Enlightenment. Yes, which gave him. Let's put it this way. I don't think Sholem Aleichem could have written so movingly and convincingly about the very confined life, intellectually and physically confined life, of villagers without that wider perspective that he would have gotten from his father and also from his own studies. I mean, he was definitely an intellectual, Sholem Aleichem, even though his pose as under that pen name, his pose is that of just a villager, just one of the guys. You know, he tells these stories about people who lived quite impoverished lives, whose only source of beauty and wonder would have been in their religion. And I think that's probably not an inaccurate version of a lot of people, of the way a lot of people lived, Jewish and non-Jewish. I mean, we know that there was religious fervor in other faiths as well, among the poor people of the 18th and 19th centuries.
And he certainly took as his, I guess, I wouldn't say models, but I mean, in terms of literature, he was very aware of the great Russian literature of the 19th century, which late 19th century.
Yes,
which
yes.
is also filled with social analysis and consciousness of
yes,
modernity replacing.
Right, right. Ferment, right. Well, the huge changes in Russian society having to do with the freeing of the serfs and the breaking up the large estates, that was also reflected in Sholem Aleichem's Ukraine. Relations between landowners and peasants, which were very often negotiated by Jews serving as bailiffs or treasurers on large estates, was in a constant state of a readjustment and ferment, turmoil even.
You've spoken a bit about how Sholem Aleichem responded to some of this. Is there something you'd like to elaborate a bit more on that?
Well, yes, because his great subjects are the work that he's best known for in the modern world is his stories of Tevye the milkman. Those stories were morphed into the musical Fiddler on the Roof, the musical play, which has brought his name and his work into the consciousness of many, many more people who than ever would have known it if he had remained an obscure writer of Yiddish short stories. I mean, even though his work has been translated and a lot of people read it, I think, still, Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof have made him a household word. So the great themes of the Tevye stories are the different lives pursued by his daughters, all of whom pull away from the confined, restricted village life of Tevye and his wife. One of them has a boyfriend who's a free thinker. One of them has a boyfriend who is not Jewish. And one of them, I can't remember what happens to the third, but the lives of these children, I mean, it very succinctly embodies many of the changes going through the Jewish community at the time, which, is always a good thing in a writer.
He transformed, as you said right at the beginning of our discussion, vernacular Yiddish, the conversational language of ordinary people, into a literary language.
Yes, yes.
Yet it struck me very surprising that he didn't use Yiddish as his vernacular in his own household, that his children spoke Russian. He spoke Russian with his children.
Yes.
Maybe it was Ukrainian. There's an argument if you were Ukrainian, you would say probably spoke Ukrainian, but maybe not. Maybe he spoke Russian because that was the literary language he admired. What do we learn in this film about the fate of the Yiddish language, which he raised to a literary level?
Yes, not a great deal. I was surprised that not more was made of that, because, of course, in the early 20th century, with the outpouring of Jews as refugees to North America mainly, there was a flowering of Yiddish culture. Yiddish theaters were opened in certainly New York, Boston, Chicago, probably Toronto, I don't know. And Yiddish newspapers flourished. So there was still quite a large population for whom Yiddish was the language of expression, both high culture and low. It was the vernacular, as you say. It was also the source of art. The Yiddish theater, which, as I understand it, was dominated by Lithuanian Jews, was quite popular. There were several Yiddish theaters in New York City. Sholem Aleichem was desperate to break into that world and traveled to New York at a certain point to try to become a playwright, and was rudely turned away. I think he was disappointed. He did have a play produced, but it tanked, as we would say. Still, he did not. He was an intellectual and a dandy, and he did not speak Yiddish in his home, as you say. He spoke Russian and perhaps French, as high class Russians always did.
I remember being in Poland in 1958, and buying a poster advertising some Yiddish theater. But it wasn't produced by Jews in Poland any longer. It was produced by other Poles who weren't Jewish, who had wanted to sustain this theater.
Wow, wanted to sustain this theater. After ridding Poland of virtually its entire Jewish population, that's really interesting. I spent some time in Poland in the 1980s, and the nice stores had little Jew dolls in them. So it was clear that Jewish culture, which had been virtually eradicated from Polish soil, was back as kitsch. And I wonder if that's the case with this Yiddish theater. I mean, when I was in Romania, there was still a Yiddish theater in Bucharest, but they were producing Woody Allen in Yiddish. So I don't know how else to say it, except that Jewish culture was somebody analogized it to Native culture in North America, or Black culture perhaps. It becomes kitsch. It becomes you have dolls and music of the conquered culture, of the subordinate culture, and I think that's what happened to Yiddish in Poland in the 1950s.
Well, it struck me that when we see about Fiddler on the Roof and talking of kitsch, that's what happened to it in America. But
yes, that's true.
After his death, the film did explore the fate of some of his creation in different parts of the world, in revolutionary Russia,
right,
in Palestine, in America. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that was quite interesting, as you say. The fate of Sholem Aleichem's work in Russia was interesting because it peaked. I mean, there was a great deal of interest and a great deal of support for that work. For a while, and then currents of anti-Semitism supervened, and it was not okay. In Israel, on the other hand, the speaking of Yiddish was actively discouraged. There were some moving scenes in the film of people learning forcibly learning Hebrew because the new people, the new men and women of Israel, were not going to be Yiddish speakers, who were seen by the Zionists in power at the time as weak, victimized people. So Yiddish was the language of oppression, European oppression, and if we wanted to be free of that, they all had to learn Hebrew.
And what about America?
Well, let's see. In my lifetime, there certainly were Yiddish speakers when I was a child. I mean, in my mother's family, it was very much a case of pas devant les enfants. You know, you spoke Yiddish if you didn't want the kids to understand. My father's family never had any Yiddishkeit, so there was nothing there. I mean, they were pretty firmly assimilated into North American culture. But Yiddish speakers, it's a generational thing, of course. As the older generation dies out, some of the younger generation comes up. And, for example, Aaron Lansky has started this National Yiddish Book Center. He's got examples of virtually every book published in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the Yiddish Book Center, it's had a kind of bumpy road. It's lost its quarters time and time again because sources of support dry up, although many people have tried to keep it going. But I think nowadays there is an interest in Yiddish on the part of young people that I would compare to young native people keeping their tribal languages alive. It's a matter of historical interest. It's something that they want to be more in touch, perhaps, with their roots, with where they came from, the culture of their parents and grandparents. Would you say that that was that corresponds to your impression?
I find it, one of the people in the film said that Shalom Aleichem was describing a culture as it was disappearing.
Yes.
And in a sense, the language is the expression of that culture, and that culture and the language so wither. So people do speak sometimes, but you need a very large social base.
Yes.
To sustain a language. I mean, you need a community that exists as such in that language for it to really be vibrant, as opposed to, you know, something which did exist, which we have seen. We know ancient languages. Mm-hmm. People are experts. Mm-hmm. There are treasures hidden within them.
Yes.
But they're accessible by specialists as opposed to
a
community.
Right, that a community of non-specialists. Yeah, right. It's interesting that description, that he described a culture as it was changing, and yet his work was in one way a rescue mission. His work brought that culture into much wider currency than it would have had otherwise. So I think a lot of my sense is that people whose introduction to Yiddish and Yiddish literature is via Shalom Aleichem and Fiddler on the Roof may not know what they're getting into. I mean, there are lots of other writers. Moshe Mendelssohn Sforim is a name that comes to mind. I can't recall any others, but there are other wonderful writers, novelists and short story writers and playwrights in Yiddish.
Well, we'll leave that for our listeners to explore. Thanks
yes.
a lot, Martha.
Oh, you're welcome.
I've been speaking with Martha Ross. She's an avid fan of film, regularly reviews them for Red Eye, along with her partner, Marty Roth. Martha's also a member of the Vancouver Collective that produces Canada's progressive Jewish magazine, Outlook, and you'll find her writing there as well.